She's such a fine line between stupid and clever.
Yeah, she's a little turnabout.
Anyway, it's been interesting.
That's the understatement of the year.
Just jerking your chin. I'll juice you up.
Oh, this is the worst looking hat I ever saw. Oh, it looks good on you, though.
You are a smelly pirate hooker.
War does funny things to men.
Welcome to Aspect Radio. I'm Corey Kraft.
And I'm Ben Flanagan, and this week we are going to switch gears from the dark and dour and bleak Dark Knight Rises and the rest of Christopher Nolan's work back to comedy. We've talked about contemporary comedies recently on this show. We listed our top 10 favorite comedies of the past decade, and this time on the heels of The Campaign, starring Will Ferrell and Zach Galifianakis and directed by Jay Roach, who's made a lot of really good contemporary comedies, we're going to talk about our favorite movie comedy duels. So this is going to involve rivals on screen, like you see in The Campaign. Will Ferrell and Zach Galifianakis play political figures who are running against each other for Congress. One's a Democrat, one's a Republican, and they're just a couple of boneheads vying for the same office. It's a relatively decent comedy, in my opinion, Corey, but it's not really one that I feel like we should spend a lot of time on here. But before we go into our favorite comedy rivalries, why don't you talk a little bit about what you thought of The Campaign?
Yeah, I agree. I thought it was relatively decent and a fun way to pass 88 minutes or however brief it is. But there's nothing remarkably fresh or new about it. It's just sort of a handful of really good jokes in the hands of some performers doing established personas. Will Ferrell basically does his George W. Bush shtick, and Zach Galifianakis sort of does a riff on his Seth Galifianakis character of his brother, who's more effete and prancing around the whole movie. I mean, it's funny, and the two really do play off one another well, but it's not going to be one of those contemporary classics I think we go back and look at in a few years. Though I do think the movie is interesting for being pretty blatantly about, I don't know, a very real issue, campaign finance reform, while being pretty nonpartisan. I'd say the Barbs, I mean, it's not really concerned with politics other than labeling each character, you know, in which political party they're in.
They did themselves a favor by doing that.
Yeah, I mean,
they're both sort of, like I said, boneheaded equally.
Yeah, the characters don't get into any substantive politics or anything, which is part of the joke. They just spend most of the time arguing about nonsense, and that's pretty funny, but it doesn't add up to anything more than a pleasant good time, even though there are some pretty fun supporting performances in this movie, specifically Dylan McDermott, who I think has some of the funniest moments in the movie. The movie kind of takes these pretty fun performers and doesn't do much with them. It's pretty firmly centered on Ferrell and Galifianakis. So you have figures like Dan Aykroyd and John Lithgow and Brian Cox and even Jason Sudeikis, who has a handful of funny moments himself, and it doesn't really do a whole lot with them. But, you know, for R-rated comedy and for these pretty appealing performers just sort of riffing on each other the whole time, it's enjoyable for what it is.
Yeah, I'm mostly in agreement with you here regarding a performance like McDermott. I think it's sort of a broad shtick that runs out of steam as the movie goes along, but I think that reflects the movie itself.
Yeah.
The first half hour I thought was relatively strong and had enough laugh-out-loud moments to promise me a decent rest of the movie, but it starts petering out, I'd say, during the first hour with some nice, again, laugh out loud moments sprinkled in here and there, but there are just some moments of plot where this movie has to slow down when I caught myself not laughing at all and just sort of listening to these supporting characters explain what the evil folks behind this election and behind these candidates were actually up to. And I thought it kind of fell flat, as those kinds of storylines tend to do in broad comedies. But when the laughs deliver, they really do. Like I said, in the first half hour, there are a couple of sequences that I found just plain hilarious. Number one, the dinner table scene with Zach Galifianakis' family, where he asks his kids to come clean about certain things,
right,
because the media scrutiny is about to sort of ratchet itself up. I thought that was funny.
I didn't like that. I kind of felt that like that was an outtake from Talladega Nights.
I think it did more effectively in The Campaign what they tried to do in Talladega Nights. It's like, well, Talladega Nights, I wish, had been R-rated. And
right,
it had the limitations of being PG-13. This time, they can say whatever they want. It has an R rating. And I think that had Talladega Nights gotten that rating, this is what you might have seen. and I think it's a little bit better. And what really makes most of it work is Zach Galifianakis. I think
he's
that
very good.
He really immerses himself into this character like we've seen him do on, I think, Jimmy Kimmel's Late Night Show and on Between Two Ferns as Seth Galifianakis. And it's a really funny character, and I'm glad he got this sort of platform to introduce the character. And another, when they have their first debate and they're sort of trash-talking each other off microphone in front of everybody as they're shaking hands, I thought there were some really funny little barbs there.
Yeah.
But otherwise, again, aside from Galifianakis' performance and some things riddled throughout, like you said, this movie doesn't have much to say really seriously. I think the most effective message it kind of delivers is, look at what politicians, look at the ridiculous and just comic things they'll do to win an election. I mean, it goes as far as one shooting another in the leg. So there are some funny moments as a result of that. But again, not really memorable. It's not one I wish to revisit. Maybe like other Will Ferrell movies and movies from the Adam McKay canon, it'll get better with a few more watches on cable.
Well, I think the difference is Adam McKay's films don't tend to slow down like this one does. There's always some gag happening, I feel like, in his movies that sneaks up on you on repeat viewings. I don't think that Jay Roach, the director here, though he has directed a lot of movies I find pretty funny, is as gifted with the absurd as Adam McKay. And I think that Will Ferrell as a performer naturally gravitates towards that, as does Galifianakis, as evidenced by his work. And they get a chance to cut loose, but it feels nevertheless restrained in a lot of ways by the plot of this movie, which I found kind of unfortunate. I feel like Adam McKay, maybe to the film's detriment, but, you know, who knows, would just let them riff and just let them go off and do their own weird thing for more than the campaign allows them to do.
Yeah, and like you said, it could have been to the film's detriment, too. I think that the problems with some of Adam McKay's movies is that he lets them riff a little bit too hard. And in some cases, it really works, like in Anchorman and Step Brothers. And in some cases, it doesn't really as much. For me, Talladega Nights and even The Other Guys didn't gel as much. And I think with scripted comedy, you give yourself more of an opportunity to be memorable. You don't date yourself nearly as much. And I think that is one advantage this movie seems to have. And Jay Roach has directed political comedies, of course, like Game Change and Recount, these movies for HBO that are actually based on real events. So he's sort of blending his political comedy background with this absurdity that you're talking about here. And it's not really the most potent mixture, but again, it's good enough, I guess, for 88 minutes. But honestly, I felt like it was a little longer than that. It didn't feel totally breezy when it started to slow down there. But one of the things that a movie like this has to thrive on is the chemistry of the leads. Mm-hmm. And I think it was solid. These guys know how to play off of each other, and it was really good. And to have one of these movie rivalries or comedic rivalries or duels that we're about to talk about, it definitely has to have that chemistry. So in your opinion, while I don't think the campaign is going to make our list here of the best of this category, do you think that their chemistry got it done?
Yeah, it did. You know, like you said, it does kind of peter out near the end, and when you have to go in for the requisite Hollywood ending, you kind of wish that you were watching a braver, more sure-footed film than what the campaign ultimately ends up being. But as far as Ferrell and Galifianakis bouncing off each other, I think they do that rather well.
I actually like this better than The Other Guys. I would take this over The Other
Guys.
No,
I wouldn't.
You're a fan of that, too.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of The Other Guys. And that movie, again, like Adam McKay's other films, just gets funnier every time.
Well, let's move on to this list. We're going to do a new kind of top five here on this show, where it's going to be three of our favorites from a particular category, in this case, movie comedy duels. We're going to offer three of our favorites that we just downright love. We're going to have one underrated pick from the category, and then we're going to have our worst pick, or the worst example that we can think of that category. And so, Corey, I mean, if you want to just share some of your criteria for this list, it's pretty basic.
Yeah, you know, I struggled with thinking of a number of comedic duel films that present two, like, super established comedic personas bouncing off one another. But as far as comedies with two people who have opposing interests that brush up against each other, there are hundreds and hundreds of examples. So I was able to put together a pretty robust list, even though it's kind of hard to find other examples of movies that have two, like, huge comedic stars bouncing off one another, or at least good ones, because I guess there are some examples of that that don't work that well.
Well, I have a pretty long list of favorites. I had more trouble coming up with worst examples.
Yeah.
just because I didn't really seek those out as much. I didn't go back into my favorite films and favorite comedies to find the worst examples that I could. And I think that would be a much easier list to make because of how many bad comedies there are.
Well, I'm sure if we were presented with like a list of all of the comedies that have come out in the last, I don't know, 20 years, it'd be pretty easy to pick out ones that aren't good. But I had the same problem. I can think of one pretty clear example that just didn't work for me. So that's the one I'm going with.
Yeah, me too. And why don't we start with one of our favorites though? And I'll start things off. I'll be transparent here and admit that most of my list is comprised of two men sort of butting heads in these movies. So to start things off, I'll go with two women from a very recent comedy, which I think is one of the best comedies of the decade, and it's from Bridesmaids.
Yeah.
And it's Kristen Wiig versus Rose Byrne.
Wow, it looks like somebody's really relaxing now.
Yeah, wow.
What are you guys talking about up here?
We are,
we're going to a restaurant tonight. I know the owner, so he's just
you
coming.
Do? Oh, Helen is the owner.
I think these two just have incredible chemistry, and it's one of the best mano a mano, just outright dogfights on screen that I've seen in a long time. And unexpectedly, Rose Byrne really steps up to the plate with some incredible comic timing, and things don't get more awkward in movies than they do at the first engagement party when they're giving their speech and they're sort of going back and forth, stealing the microphone from each other. But things just get so ugly to where Kristen Wiig has this just classic meltdown at one of the bridal showers. And Rose Byrne is just classically smarmy.
Yeah, that's a good example. It's one of my honorable mentions.
Okay. But
yeah, that's, I mean, you know, even though those two women are part of a larger ensemble, of course, the conflict between the two of them sort of drives the movie. And it's really funny. I mean, Kristen Wiig in that movie is just amazing.
To make up this list, too, it's like, at what lengths will these people go to one-up each other?
Yeah.
And I think Kristen Wiig reaches some pretty pathetic heights, or my, lows anyway.
Yeah. Well, my first example is a perfect example of characters trying to one-up each other. Though, this is an interesting movie because these characters start off as friends, turn into enemies, go back to friends. It's a pretty complicated but nevertheless super amusing relationship, and it's from one of my favorite films. I'm sure that it just popped into your head. It's Jason Schwartzman and Bill Murray in Rushmore. Jason Schwartzman plays Max Fisher, a precocious, I guess is the best word, student at the prestigious private school Rushmore Academy, who meets a lonely and bitter millionaire Herman Bloom, played by Bill Murray. They both, by circumstance, end up vying for the affections of a teacher at the school, even though, you know, naturally, she's an adult and Max Fisher is a child, and things go awry from there. Of course, this is probably the best example of Wes Anderson's trademark whimsy and humor and melancholy, but it's one of the best examples I could think of.
She's my Rushmore, Max.
Yeah, I know. She was mine, too.
It was my number one. And I'm just going to throw that out there and go ahead and scratch it off the list.
You've got plenty of others.
So I can pop one of my honorable mentions up into my list. But yeah, everything you said is exactly right. It's my favorite. It has one of the best just sort of dueling revenge montages I've ever seen in movies, set to this great Who song. And it really is the best example I can think of what to show somebody as an example of Wes Anderson's work. That montage itself and the music that he uses, it's just, this is Wes Anderson. And those two actors elevate it in a way that's just, it's hard to describe.
I figured we would overlap on that one. I've got one other that we might overlap on too.
Okay, well, here, let me go with my number two for favorites. And it's from Ferris Bueller's Day Off. And it's Matthew Broderick versus Jeffrey Jones, who plays Ed Rooney, the principal of Ferris Bueller's school, who is just out to get Ferris Bueller the entire movie. And it's just one of the best high school comedy bad guys ever. And Jeffrey Jones is one of these actors who got into a little trouble in recent years, or in the latter part of his career anyway. I think he's starting to do a little work, but he just did so much great work in the late 80s, or mid to late 80s and early 90s, just as this typically a bad guy. He played the good guy from time to time in a movie like, this is a really heady reference here, Mom and Dad Save the World. Oh, I don't know if you've seen that.
I have.
Well, I'm not recommending people go check that out right now unless they want to see John Lovitz as an alien bad guy.
I'm sure you could find it on VHS at a thrift store somewhere.
Certainly, or, you know, my shelf, but I'm not willing to admit it, but it's really great. Ferris outsmarts him the entire time, and he's slightly oblivious to a lot of what Rooney is trying to do throughout the day, who's just sort of aimlessly tailing Ferris because he knows he's up to no good. And just some great sequences, including Rooney climbing into the backyard of Ferris's home and then eventually breaking into his home just to find out if this like 17-year-old kid is skipping class.
Yeah.
He's so obsessed with what this child is up to. And talk about sleazy. He's one of the best. So your next one.
Well, funny you should mention Matthew Broderick, because he is one half of my next pairing. The other half is Reese Witherspoon, and the film is Alexander Payne's Election.
Good pick.
Yeah, that, I mean, it's just one of the bitterest but most hilarious comedies,
God,
I think of the 1990s.
That's a great pick.
Yeah, it's so awesome. Matthew Broderick plays this increasingly upset teacher at a high school in the Midwest who begins to fixate on an overachieving student named Tracy Flick, who is running for her class president, even going so far as to sponsor another candidate against her, just because the very idea of somebody who is that successful at such a young age seems to bother him. She's no saint either, as we grow to discover, but the duel between them escalates pretty quickly and ridiculously. Say what you will about Alexander Payne's later work, but I still think this is his funniest movie. Just from pure comedy standpoint.
Yeah, no argument. Yeah, and he and Rooney kind of parallel each other in some ways.
A little bit.
This obsession with these teenagers who are controlling their lives, unfortunately. But no, that's a great pick. My, I guess, new number one here is something that I just hold totally near and dear to my heart. It's from one of my favorite filmmakers ever, the late, great John Hughes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, and it's Steve Martin versus John Candy.
That's a good pick.
And you had mentioned in Rushmore, you have these people who start out as friends and become enemies and become friends again. And this start out as acquaintances, awkward acquaintances, become enemies almost instantaneously, at least from the perspective of Steve Martin, who sort of immediately hates every single thing that John Candy does. And the audience does too, in a way. You can't help but love him, but you can't help but be annoyed by him too. So you sort of feel for Steve Martin's, for lack of a better term, jerk character. Then they eventually make amends in a very sweet way, in one of the most heartwarming sequences, I think, in film history. And this was, I believe, in the early to mid 80s anyway, just a really great R-rated road comedy, and R-rated too. John Hughes made a lot of young person friendly movies, but mm-hmm. when he went R with this and The Breakfast Club, I think he was probably at his best. Just telling stories of all ages in adult ways. Anyway, it's just two legends on screen together going at it in just hilarious ways.
So. Yeah, it's a really funny movie. And I mean, Steve Martin in that movie is just pretty amazing. My number one is from what I consider the best buddy road comedy ever made. It's Charles Grodin and Robert De Niro in Midnight Run. De Niro plays the bounty hunter who's sent to pick up Grodin's mob accountant and take him back to Los Angeles from New York. Things don't go that well for them, of course, because the FBI and the mob are after Grodin, who is this really buttoned down, talkative, neurotic sort of person, to De Niro's more hard-boiled ex-cop character. They get to know each other a little bit better throughout the movie, but I mean, the movie's hilarious. It's got some of the best action of the 80s, and it's just probably as good as that sort of buddy road movie will ever be done. It's just a classic.
It is. It totally is. And what's interesting about Midnight Run, it gets name dropped a lot when filmmakers or stars today, say of like the Apatow gang and everything, when they're talking about the films they want to make, they often drop Midnight Run's name and say, this is the kind of movie we want to make. And I don't think that, honestly, anybody has been able to sort of replicate what Midnight Run was able to do.
Well, Charles Grodin is just such an appealing and funny performer. And that's script by Martin Brest, who directed it as well, is just one of the best ever of its kind anyway. I mean, there's the structure of that, just the constant shifting of the power dynamics between the two and just the different locations they end up in. Just a beautiful cross-country movie visually, and just it's just so funny. I have to confess, I saw this movie for the first time pretty recently, so it's fresh on my mind, but it had this reputation as sort of this classic example, and when I watched it, I could totally tell why. I mean, anybody who loves movies like that, or movies at all, will find a lot to love about Midnight Run.
I want to run through my honorable mentions really quick. You mentioned Charles Grodin already, and this, I don't know if this is going to be obscure. I really hope you've seen this movie, but it's Martin Short versus Charles Grodin. In the movie Clifford.
Yeah, I have seen that movie. It's bizarre.
It's bizarre. It's one of the most fascinating movies I've ever seen, in that this is not something that A, should have been made, or B, that I should like as much as I do, but it's arguably the most hilarious thing I think Martin Short has ever done. It's absurd. We're going to say absurd a lot in this conversation, maybe, but Clifford is just brilliant, where Martin Short stars as, I think, like a 10-year-old boy.
Yeah, he's, yeah.
And Charles Grodin is serves as his caretaker throughout the movie.
I think it's his uncle, right?
Yeah.
Something like that.
It's seek it out. I won't tell you anymore, but it's great.
There's that great line that he has to Clifford, where Clifford is like, I don't think you like me that much. And he's like, are you joking? I've had nothing but the utmost respect for you for your entire life, or something like that. It's just, I mean, Charles Grodin makes that movie.
Do you like Clifford?
I like what I remember of it. I don't think I've seen it since I was a child, but
Seek it out.
I'd like to rewatch it.
Yeah, it's pretty wild. Okay, going down the list, from This Is Spinal Tap, I think a really great rivalry is developed mid-movie between Michael McKean and Christopher Guest mm-hmm. as members of that band. From Caddyshack, Ted Knight versus everybody,
yeah.
But Ted Knight specifically versus Rodney Dangerfield. They butt heads incredibly in that movie. This one is more of a friendly one that turns into a rivalry late, but I want to throw it out there, a 90s favorite from Dumb and Dumber, Jim Carrey and Jeff Daniels. Let's get that sequel made, guys. From Anchorman, Will Ferrell versus Christina Applegate.
That's a good one.
Great Battle of the Sexes comedy there. From the original Nutty Professor, Jerry Lewis versus Jerry Lewis, where you have Buddy Love versus Professor Julius Kelp. The remake Nutty Professor to me is really funny. I think it's great, but the original is just, you can't beat it. Jerry Lewis just gives a tour de force performance. Another Will Ferrell movie from Step Brothers, Will Ferrell versus John C. Reilly.
That's one of mine as well.
It's brilliant. And that rounds it out for my honorable mentions.
Well, I actually have a lot that you didn't mention, so that's nice.
All right.
You mentioned Jerry Lewis versus Jerry Lewis. I'll mention Nicolas Cage versus Nicolas Cage in Adaptation as the feuding Kaufman twins, sort of ideologically opposed. Bill Murray versus William Atherton in Ghostbusters. Just the interplay for that. I mean, William Atherton doesn't even have a lot of screen time, but the interplay there is just classic. Here's a trio. I couldn't narrow this down, so this is kind of a stretch. Colin Farrell and Brendan Gleeson versus Ralph Fiennes in Bruges.
It's a good one.
Particularly near the end of that movie when Ralph Fiennes really gets into the action. And the three that I really wanted to include in my main list, but you know, you have to cut it off somewhere. First, Woody Allen and Alan Alda in Crimes and Misdemeanors.
Great pick.
Yeah, just a total awkward one-upmanship situation there. Eddie Murphy and Dan Aykroyd in Trading Places. And Cary Grant and Irene Dunne in Leo McGarry's The Awful Truth.
Good picks. Real
Thank
good
you.
Picks.
Thank you.
Well, let's talk about briefly about our underrated picks. Mine includes the aforementioned Robert De Niro, and it's in what is, I think, in my top three Martin Scorsese movies of all time, and it also includes Jerry Lewis from The King of Comedy.
I didn't even think about it.
Rupert Pupkin.
I didn't even think about that, but that's awesome.
Just one of the great film characters of all time, and this one gets lost in the fold, I think, when people are even listing off their favorite Scorsese movies.
Not for me.
Oh, I try never to forget it, yeah. Because it's one that, I mean, you have the Goodfellas and the Mean Streets and the Taxi Drivers and Raging Bull, obviously, and King of Comedy is just one that gets left out for whatever reason. I think people might think it is too 80s, and it also has Sandra Bernhardt, of all people, in a supporting role as this maniacal fan who goes a little further than Rupert Pupkin at times, but De Niro is just flat out brilliant like he always is in Martin Scorsese's movies, and Jerry Lewis, who'd have thought that he could turn in such a great dramatic performance, and at times he just, I know that his real life self might actually reflect what you see as him playing Jerry Langford in this movie, but man, it's a great performance. This stuff is Oscar worthy, and it's up there with the best movies about obsession,
yeah.
I think, and mental illness in some ways, but it's up there with Scorsese's best and De Niro's best performances ever.
I agree. It's a good pick. I had two underrated choices.
Okay.
Because I couldn't narrow this down. The first, I don't know how underrated this is anymore because people have had probably about 7 years of hearing about this movie and how good it is from people who bothered to see it in its theatrical run, but not many people did see it in its theatrical run. I'm proud to say that I'm one of them, but it's Robert Downey Jr. and Val Kilmer in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, Shane Black's film noir LA comedy that find those two, one a petty criminal who sort of tricked his way into a Hollywood job as an actor, and the other, the private eye, the very real private eye, who is supposed to be sort of coaching him as he learns the ropes for his role, and they both sort of get involved in this very real hard-boiled mystery that ends up being incredibly funny as well. It's just one of my favorite movies of the last few years, and people should see it if they haven't already. But again, I think that a lot of people have talked about it enough since it came out for that maybe not to be as underrated, but here's a movie that I think is underrated because when people talk about it, they don't seem to like it, and I don't understand why, particularly since it's from some of the, well, my favorite filmmakers in the world. Though I think that most romantic comedies could be potentially, at least through part of the way into the movie, belong on this list. But I think one of the funniest examples in recent memory is George Clooney and Catherine Zeta-Jones in Intolerable Cruelty from the Coen brothers, a movie that I think is outstanding and funny. Even if it is one of the Coen brothers' weakest films, that's a hell of a scale. And I know that you can think of at least one movie that I really like that's probably worse than that.
Yeah, I think probably. But no, it's an underrated movie in general. Yeah, and their interplay is great. It's a great throwback to screwball comedy. Yeah. Done in the style of the Coens, like nobody else can do it. But yeah, that's a good pick.
You know, I just wish more people, I don't know, would come around to that and The Lady Killers while we're on the subject. I mean, I don't understand why everybody just hates that movie, but okay.
I can tell you why, but that'll be a whole other show.
Yeah, we should do that show.
Okay. Well, that brings us to our worst ever. And honestly, when I just sat and thought about it for a minute, it became an easy choice, especially given the film that we sort of reviewed today and the folks that are involved with that. But it's another movie made by Jay Roach and starring one of the people that was in the campaign. And it's one that we kind of butted heads over a few episodes ago or a long time ago. And it's Dinner for Schmucks, a remake of, I think, was it a French film?
It's a French film.
Made. Yeah, and it stars Paul Rudd and Steve Carell. And I won't say they're exactly rivals from beginning to end. Like I said, same is the case, I think, with Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, where you have sort of a one-sided rivalry where Paul Rudd just can't stand this guy, like Steve Martin can't stand John Candy in that movie. I just didn't think anything about the movie worked, especially Steve Carell's bizarre performance. He didn't have anything going for him in the script that would help him along. He just had these really stupid quirks that would have bothered anybody, I guess, and are just too out there to really understand to let bother you, yet Paul Rudd seems to hate every single thing that he does, and he hates him so much and spends the entire movie just hating this character up until the very last second of the movie that you don't want to spend any time with Paul Rudd either, and you can't really feel for him. And to me, it just really set this very uncomfortable tone that, again, was very awkward in that I just didn't really ever feel like laughing at a movie that involves so many funny people. And it just never came together for me.
Yeah, you know, I don't love that movie, but I think it's funny. I mean, a lot of the jokes did work for me. So, I mean, it's not something that I want to argue with you about, but, you know, you didn't like it. You didn't like it.
I didn't like it.
That's fine. I wonder how you feel about my choice, which was I sort of picked, you know, my list from movies that I own or that I really do love. So it's kind of harder to think of the bad ones because I think there are a lot of bad ones that I've just kind of forgotten about. This is a movie that I'd never think about. But when I was kind of thinking about movies that when I started really going to the movies a lot and, you know, really being kind of really grown to anticipate movies, this is one that stood out as being particularly disappointing. It's 2003's film Anger Management with Adam Sandler and Jack Nicholson. Not disappointing, I think, because it's an Adam Sandler movie, but because I expected Jack Nicholson to really burn the place down, so to speak, and he just kind of didn't. It's kind of turgid and not very funny, which would describe, I think, in fairness, a lot of Sandler's films, but, you know, you expect something a little bit more from Jack Nicholson, and you expect him to sort of be a more potent comic force there than he was.
Yeah, I agree with you. That was a big disappointment for me, because I saw the potential, too, for a Jack Nicholson Adam Sandler comedy. That was back when I think we all collectively thought Adam Sandler still had a little game.
Yeah.
And was able to make good movies. Did that follow Big Daddy, or what did that follow?
Well, I don't think it directly followed Big Daddy, but I don't remember.
It was pretty close.
Yeah.
There was only like one movie
between. Yeah, they probably were pretty close to one another, but I don't remember.
Mr. Deeds or something.
Maybe.
Little Nicky, I don't know, which I thought Little Nicky was funny personally, but I think the Anger Management or whichever one of those movies, whatever came before it, that really started to show the warning signs of what would happen with the rest of Adam Sandler's career, how he would squander his own talent and also big stars like Jack Nicholson who came on board for his movies. And ever since then, you've kind of gotten these replicants of each other. His movies are kind of a blur to me now, mm-hmm. where I can't really remember one from the other. And Anger Management for me kind of started that.
Yeah, I feel like another good example for the worst would be Adam Sandler and Adam Sandler from Jack and Jill, which I actually saw.
Yeah. You know, my brother loves that movie.
What do you mean loves?
I mean loves. Like, I'm not being facetious here. He loves this movie.
Like, unironically?
Likes this movie a lot. Thinks it's hilarious. Not being ironic. He does not ironically love Jack and Jill. He thinks it's a really funny movie. So he's disagreeing with you as we speak. Which is, this is an incredibly sad confession that I've just laid out here.
Well, I mean, everybody needs to hear from that sort of contrarian every once in a while.
I think he's actually looking around or asking, what don't people see here? You know,
that baffles me.
Well, you know, I've mentioned Jerry Lewis a couple of times here, and I think that's one person he would point to, saying that this is sort of Adam Sandler doing Jerry Lewis, playing multiple characters, first of all, but just again in this sort of very absurd slapstick way.
Yeah, but you can do it poorly.
It can work, but it can also fall flat right on its face.
This is not a good example of Adam Sandler trying to do Jerry Lewis. Just the fact that he tried isn't enough
right
to earn it any credit.
I don't want to go on a Jack and Jill tangent here, especially since I opted not to see the film. I am fine with not having an opinion on it. If it ever happens, then so be it. But I think I can live my life without seeing Jack and Jill.
I think that might be the best option.
So that rounds it out, I think. Andrew, anything you want to contribute?
Yeah, I was writing some stuff down while you guys were having your discussion. These are not necessarily good movies. In fact, most of these are mediocre movies, but they're just movies I thought of that might be interesting. Throw Mama from the Train with Billy Crystal and Danny DeVito really fits this category. Kind of a meh movie.
It's pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, I enjoy, and these are, a lot of these are movies from my childhood, so I just kind of, you know, sometimes the movies that you watch growing up, you end up liking even though they're pretty terrible. Turner and Hooch. Hooch being the opposite. But if you watch that movie, the dog is legitimately pretty funny. Like, does a lot of funny stuff. Like, it works.
Yeah, he's relentless against Tom Hanks.
He is. Toy Story, actually, I think, is interesting.
Yeah, that's a really good example.
With Buzz Lightyear and Woody. You know, it's easy not to think about animated movies in this context, but that was just one that came to mind. I think that's a really good one. And then the only other one I thought of as maybe an example of a bad one is School for Scoundrels with John Heath and Billy Bob Thornton.
Yeah, I thought about that, too.
Never seen it.
It's not very good.
It's not very good.
I was reminded of another recent example that disappointed me, not quite as much as Dinner for Schmucks did, but, you know, obviously when you think of Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, unfortunately, you have to think of Todd Phillips' movie Due Date, which came out just a few years ago, and it was forgettable, I think, in the same way that The Campaign ended up being, but I think The Campaign's a little better. I just don't really see the point of a movie like Due Date when guys like Todd Phillips and Robert Downey Jr. and Zach Galifianakis know something like Planes, Trains, and Automobiles exists, yet they're going to push on and essentially remake it in a totally inferior way.
Due Date felt like we can make a cheap movie with these stars and probably bring in some money.
Between Hangover movies, it won't be that much work.
Yeah.
I think that movie has some pretty funny moments.
It does.
Mostly courtesy of Downey, I must admit, to not really finding Galifianakis all that funny in that movie. But pairing Robert Downey Jr. up with a more flamboyantly wacky comedy star just seems like it has some potential.
Oh, on paper it made sense.
Yeah, just because he's such a combustible personality that just seeing, I don't know, there's potential there. I don't think Due Date really lived up to the potential, but I think it's fine.
Well, with these rivalry movies, like I said with Dinner for Schmucks, the same goes for Due Date, where you have this sort of straight man character played by Downey and Paul Rudd, that the straight man character is so aggravated by the funny man, it comes across as nasty in those two movies, and you don't really see the potential for them to come around. And once they finally do, it doesn't feel nearly as warm as it should and as subtle as it was in Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. And it obviously, too, the backstory of the funnier character, or the more idiotic character, I guess, needs less broad strokes, I would say.
I guess one thing that I did kind of appreciate about Due Date is, because I don't feel that the nastiness there from the straight man to the funny man is all that bad. So I kind of appreciated that in Due Date, Robert Downey Jr.'s character is pretty blatantly an asshole. But I just kind of wish that movie didn't soften him throughout, because he starts out the first part of that movie punching kids and, you know, cursing.
That was actually funny.
Yeah. So, I mean, if that had been sustained, I guess if they hadn't really softened towards one another, I probably would have liked that movie more. But, you know, these movies have to have the tendency see where the rivals sort of come together in the end and find common ground. And that's kind of unfortunate. It's unfortunate in Due Date, and it's unfortunate in the campaign.
I think next time for this three favorites, one underrated, one worse, we should probably end with the underrated, because I don't know, it feels like we're kind of ending on a downer when
we talk
about our
worst.
Yeah, we're
just trash talking everything. Yeah.
So next time we'll do
Here's another movie that I hate.
Okay, well, let's take a quick break, and we'll be back to talk DVDs. This is Aspect Radio.
Relax. All right, don't try to strike everybody out. Strikeouts are boring. Besides that, they're fascists. Throw some ground balls. It's more democratic.
We're back on Aspect Radio, talking DVDs now. Corey, one new release this week is one of my favorite movies of the year so far. I think you know what I'm talking about.
Oh, I do.
Okay.
In fact, I have it at home right now waiting for me. It is The Raid Redemption, and it is amazing. I've been talking with a lot of people this week about new DVD releases. For once, I've actually been speaking to other human beings in person. And I bring this up, this movie up, and nobody's ever heard of it. You know, it did play at the Cobb Hollywood 16 for a week before its domestic wide release sort of belly flopped. But I just feel like this is the sort of movie that action movie fans have been waiting for, because it makes every action movie made in this country since, I don't know, forever look pretty lame in comparison. I mean, I'll say that I just rewatched The Expendables in preparation for the sequel coming out this weekend, just to make sure that I did in fact think it was terrible. And yeah, I do.
Please tell me you don't own The Expendables.
No.
Okay.
But that movie just looks even worse now in comparison to The Raid, which is just, I don't know, an hour and 40 minutes or however long it is, just of nonstop action carnage with dudes wielding weapons of all sorts and their fists and just killing with impunity. I don't know. I mean, it's got a plot, but who cares?
What country is that from?
It's Indonesian.
Okay.
Directed by a Welsh director named Gareth Evans.
Okay.
But yeah, it's, you know, not an English language film, but like that matters with a martial arts film that's this impressive.
I almost prefer my martial arts films subtitled. I'm not sure why.
Most learned people do.
You know, it's just something about it. When the subtitled movie that I know is a martial arts movie comes on, I'm like, oh yeah, this is happening. We're gonna see some violence.
This is the best, you know, modern example of that, though.
It's just something we have to acknowledge, Americans, unfortunately, like is the case with soccer in America, as we, you know, contend internationally. We just can't, really. And we often are just reminded that other people do this kind of action much better than we do. So hopefully movies like The Raid and the films of John Woo from the 80s and 90s can continue to inspire American filmmakers to try to kick that kind of ass.
Yeah, absolutely. Also this week on DVD, two really necessary catalog releases made their way out. First, from the Criterion Collection, Wes Anderson's The Royal Tenenbaums, released in a beautiful Blu-ray transfer. Even if you have the DVD already, which I think most people do, this wouldn't be a bad one to upgrade just because of how wonderful Anderson's compositions are and how bright and vivid those colors in the movie are. But the big dog this week, and probably one of my most anticipated Blu-ray releases in a long time, is Steven Spielberg's Jaws, now on Blu-ray and painstakingly restored for its Blu-ray release. It's quite simply probably the new standard for studio catalog releases, sort of taking that title away from, I'd say, Fox's Alien Blu-ray release and Lionsgate's Apocalypse Now release. Both of those are great. This is just the best that this film has ever looked. And it's just wonderful, packed with special features and a must-own for any sort of serious film fan or even casual film fan, because the movie itself is just the best as well.
It's in time for Shark Week this week.
I don't think that's a coincidence.
My wife is watching that every night, and we're going to go buy Jaws tonight.
Good.
Is Jaws the greatest summer movie ever made?
You know, I've been actually entertaining the idea that Jaws might be my favorite film more and more seriously. I've watched this movie countless times since a way too early age. And yeah, I'd say it pretty easily is the best summer movie ever made, just from an artistic standpoint. I mean, you've got your Star Wars and you've got your Raiders of the Lost Ark up there too. But Jaws, I'd put in contention with, you know, anything else as being one of the best films ever made.
It's interesting how the film that sort of spawned the modern blockbuster as we know it reigns supreme as the best example of that. And when it comes on cable or a movie channel anyway, or if I pop the DVD in, I'm kind of speechless because I can't really think of anything that comes close.
The thing is, you can't look back at Jaws and say, oh, well, people just like it best because it was the first. It's not even about nostalgia. The thing is, the movie is impeccably crafted, virtually from start to finish. It has some of Spielberg's strongest character work, even with a sort of hokey-looking mechanical shark that occasionally pops up there near the end. I mean, the illusion is such that it doesn't even matter, just because of how the film is weaved, I guess, its web of suspense and terror up to that point. It's a prime example of a Hollywood thriller, and it's got some terrific performances. And, I mean, it's just the arrival of, you know, major talent on the scene with Steven Spielberg, who, of course, more than lived up to that, even though I would still make the argument that Jaws is his best work.
Well, and two, the strength of that movie, in my opinion, is the writing. The writing is just so impeccable. And obviously, you have guys like Robert Shaw, seasoned veterans who can deliver a monologue like the one about the USS Indianapolis, but people always talk about how it was a blessing in disguise that the mechanical shark didn't really work the way they wanted to, and you can definitely agree with that when you watch it, because you mentioned the terror leading up to the actual chase of the shark. When they're on Amity and they're just even talking, when Richard Dreyfuss is telling Roy Scheider about the shark and what it's capable of, what it's done, what it will do, to me, that is some of the scariest writing and just best pure movie popcorn or artistic writing that I've heard in movies.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny how a lot of the most iconic moments in Jaws were sort of thrown in during production or on the fly. The Indianapolis monologue being a prime example, worked on by three writers, I believe, including Robert Shaw himself, who sort of pared down this lengthy treatment that John Milius had produced for that scene. But you've got these great, seemingly improv moments. You have actual locals from Martha's Vineyard, where the film was filmed, playing small roles in the film. I mean, I didn't even know that the woman who played Mrs. Kentner, for example, was not a professional actress. So many of the people in this film, apart from, of course, the leads, are not professional actors. And it just shows this commitment to authenticity that is characteristic, I think, of films of the time, but not characteristic at all of the summer blockbusters that we get now.
Yeah, and one person we should name, I believe, who plays the mayor is Murray Hamilton.
Murray Hamilton.
Brilliant.
Yeah, he's
in
awesome.
The movie. He's just one of the best movie characters ever, in my opinion, just as this sleazy mayor who cares about tourism. He doesn't care about this shark problem the town mayor may not have. And one of my favorite scenes in movies is when Amity feels like they've caught the shark, and it's just this, I forget what kind of shark they refer to
it as. Tiger shark.
Tiger shark. And they go and basically perform this autopsy, or they cut open the shark to see what it's been eating. And some of the stuff they pull out of the shark is incredible. But just the fact that I think they accomplish it with one shot for most of the scene. I don't know. I'd never seen anything like it before, where you have this character like Richard Dreyfuss's, who comes across as kind of this nerdy guy. He's got glasses and he's speaking in very scientific vernacular, and he's willing to get his hands dirty. He can tie the knot that Quint asks him to. He cuts open the belly of this shark and he jumps down into the water to attack the big shark that they're looking for. It's just a fascinating character. In fact, all three of the characters are equally interesting.
Yeah, I just think that Robert Shaw as Quint, that's one of the all-time great performances in anything ever, I'd say. I mean, Robert Shaw is so good in that movie. But yeah, that's not to detract from Roy Scheider and Richard Dreyfuss, who turn in equally strong work. I mean, it's just a trio of terrific performers turning in great performances that are extraordinarily well written and feel lived in.
And what chemistry, too, between the three guys.
I mean, it doesn't hurt that apparently Robert Shaw and Richard Dreyfuss really just didn't like each other on the set, because that sort of bleeds into the performance, though, with Shaw sort of goading on Dreyfuss's character the whole time, which, I mean, apparently he did in real life on the set as well. I poured through the supplemental material on this Blu-ray last night, so I sort of fancy myself a bit of a Jaws expert at the moment. It's really just amazing. I don't know. I mean, it feels like a Robert Altman movie that features a giant shark. It just feels so confident from a 27-year-old director, and just sort of belies, I guess, what he would later become.
Totally. It's an incredible introduction, incredible shot compositions, like the scene I mentioned before. Also the scene between Dreyfuss and Murray Hamilton and Scheider when they're talking about
under
the vandalized billboard, when they're talking about closing the beaches.
That's my incredible Facebook cover photo right now.
Excellent. Well, Jaws is out. I will definitely be picking
that up. You got to pick that up. Also released Saturday, one of the biggest movies of the year so far, The Hunger Games. Did we review that? I'm pretty sure we did.
Yes, we did. I think we both liked it okay.
I think so.
Yeah.
I'll probably pick this up. I'll give it another look. Not much to say about it because everybody saw it.
Well, starting this week in theaters nationwide and in Tuscaloosa at the Cobb Hollywood 16, The Expendables 2 with a bunch of old-ass action heroes. Some of them still interesting. Some of them just pure has-beens, but I think we'll go see it just because.
Hey, I'm going to go see it.
Paranorman, made by the folks who did Coraline. I think this movie looks great.
I'm excited for it. I'm very excited for it.
I do kind of wish that it had gotten a Halloween release instead of late summer, but whatever.
It feels kind of like a dump, but I don't know. Hopefully it'll pick up some traction in a way that Coraline really didn't. I don't think that movie performed as well as it deserved to, but Coraline was one of my favorite movies of that year.
So long as these movies get released.
Yeah.
Sparkle with Whitney Houston's final performance, for whatever that's worth.
I don't know what that's worth.
Okay. The Odd Life of Timothy Green opened on Wednesday.
Yeah, it looks pretty cheesy. I don't know what to say about it. I mean, it's a plant kid. I don't know.
Well, time now for our parting shots from our friends at filmnerds.com. We start with Craig Hamilton.
This is Craig in Nashville. You know that glad feeling that overcomes you when you feel the first crisp, cool sign of fall in the air? Or the jolt of excitement that a mother gets when she feels life stirring inside her for the first time? Well, that's the feeling I get every 5 years or so when the new Paul Thomas Anderson trailer comes out. And it never fails to be a work of art in and of itself. The master trailer, much like 2007's There Will Be Blood, hits you like a ton of bricks and leaves you frozen for a moment, then encouraged and confidence renewed because you've realized that movies like this can still be made. Thankfully, there are directors working today that strive to make movies like this, and Paul Thomas Anderson is on another level. From the opening aerial shot of a guy lying on top of a battleship to the closing sunburst clip of that same guy looking at the ground, the trailer and its accompanying score merge to concoct a cinematic heroine. Make haste at once and go see this trailer. Inject yourself with it, and let the drug course through your veins, leading you to cinematic ecstasy. Bask in its beauty, bathe in its moonlight, and baptize yourself in the waters of the master, and emerge renewed.
Hey guys, it's Ben Stark with Wonder Mill Films. Just wanted to drop a quick parting shot. I was very excited to hear yesterday that Steven Spielberg announced that Raiders of the Lost Ark was going to get a IMAX re-release on September 7th. That's my favorite movie of all time, so that's a big deal for me. Also, next year we get a 3D re-release of Jurassic Park, which of course is another favorite. So I just wanted to check in real quick and list seven movies I want to see in 70mm IMAX. Whether that means they get blown up, if they get remastered, whatever it takes, I want to see these movies on the big screen. And I've broken these down by genre. So the action movie I'd like to see most in 70mm is The Road Warrior, animated movie, Sleeping Beauty, which was actually shot in 65mm, I think. It's one of the few animated movies to be done that way. Drama, In the Mood for Love from Wong Kar-wai. Westerns, this one was tough. I almost picked The Searchers, but I just recently watched that Blu-ray, which is great. But I'd really love to see Once Upon a Time in the West on a big, giant screen with awesome sound. War movie, I don't think there's a better war movie out there than Akira Kurosawa's Ron, and that would be amazing on such a big screen. Sci-fi, there's a couple of obvious picks there. I'm tempted to pick 2001, but I'm gonna go with Aliens just because I've personally not seen that film in a huge presentation ever, while I have seen 2001 on a bigger screen and on Blu-ray. And for the comedy I'd most like to see in 70mm, there's few that would work, but one that would definitely play well is Jacques Tati's Playtime. That's it, guys. Talk to you later.
Hey, this is Graham Flanagan in New York City, reporting for Film Nerds. This is my parting shot for the week. I am really looking forward to The Expendables 2. While I was somewhat of a fan of the first film, it's not perfect by any means, but you gotta love the concept, and I love the fact that with this one, they're upping the ante by inviting more famous stars from 80s and 90s action movies, in addition to Arnold Schwarzenegger, who seems to have a little bit bigger role in this one, as well as Bruce Willis and Sylvester Stallone. We're also getting Jean-Claude Van Damme as the villain, and then Chuck Norris apparently shows up. So So I am highly anticipating not the movie itself, but really the experience of seeing this movie and just kind of seeing how it all plays out. And hopefully, as we've seen with a couple of images and trailers that have popped up online, we're going to see a lot more from Arnold Schwarzenegger, who is no longer governor of California and who now has the time and obviously the desire to star in movies again. The trailer to his new movie, The Last Stand, doesn't look too promising, but you got to hope that there are a lot of talented young filmmakers who grew up watching his movies that really want to make a great Arnold Schwarzenegger movie. And I know that's possible. We'll just have to wait and see if that happens. But I love the fact that Sylvester Stallone gave up the directing reins to Simon West, who did Con Air. This all bodes very well for The Expendables 2, and I plan to be there this weekend.
You can check us out at aspectradio.net. You can email any of your feedback to feedback@aspectradio.net. Find us at twitter.com/aspectradio or facebook.com/aspectradio. And check us out on AL.com and Tusk205.com.
Of course, find us on iTunes with a quick search or click the link on our blog. You can read Corey's DVD column in Tusk Magazine every Friday in the Tuscaloosa News or on Tusk205.com. Follow his Tusk musings on Twitter at Corey Tusk Movies. Be sure to visit our friend Matt Scalici's website, filmnerds.com, where you'll find a new episode of Matt and Francesca's fantastic podcast, Cinematrimony. And thanks as always to our producer, Andrew Richardson. And until next week from Tuscaloosa, Alabama, I'm Ben Flanagan.
And I'm Corey Kraft. This has been Aspect Radio. Thanks for listening.
Jeopardizes my ability to effectively govern this student body.
Well, makes you look like an ass is what he does, Ed.